When you think of some of the great nations of history, you think of great leaders and warriors and city planners, maybe not accountants, but they were there too, playing a pivotal, if often overlooked, role. The accountants are overlooked no more. Today's guest looks at the importance of accounting through history and the many things it makes possible. Jacob Sohl's book is called The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. Jacob Sohl is a professor of history and accounting at the University of Southern California, USC. He's the author of a couple of other books and a pile of articles, a regular on the TED Talk circuit, and the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant 3 years ago for his work at investigating and illuminating how modern governments came to be. Jacob Sohl, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks. Great to be here.
You start us with a very good grabber of a story here. Tell us about Louis XIV and his account books.
Well, this Louis XIV is one of those world-famous leaders. You think of him with the Palace of Versailles, with a wig, with great culture, and with wars. But Louis XIV was the first king of a very big country to become fascinated by double-entry accounting, and he learned it. All these parties were going on and fireworks shows, he sat learning accounting. But once he learned it, and once he started doing it for a long time, the account books started showing how much these parties and wars cost him. And then he destroyed his whole accounting system and crippled France for a long time. So it's a funny story.
Maybe not to the people who lived in the decades thereafter. So essentially what happened was he realized what was going on with the money, didn't like what he was hearing, and said, that's it, no more of this.
I mean, for 20 years, he had these golden account books in his pockets. So he knew what was going on. He knew about his accounts. But the accounts started telling him a story which wasn't very pretty. And he saw himself as a divine right monarch, and he didn't see himself as being accountable. And so when his chief minister, Colbert, who was this his chief accountant, basically, when he died, he destroyed the financial system which would allow anyone to figure out what was going on and audit him and hold him responsible for anything.
And you found parallels, which I think a lot of people might find, between Louis' decision and the 2007 financial collapse?
I mean, I was sitting literally studying this when Frontline had a show about the fall of Lehman Brothers, and they showed these accounts.
At that very time, these two things coincided?
Yeah, they coincided. I mean, I was literally sitting studying this, watching the crash happen in 2007 and 8. And I watched the accountants go into Lehman Brothers and pull the books out. And I said, how could they not have known? The Fed was across the street. All the big accounting firms were there. It seemed pretty remarkable to me. And I said, you know what's going to happen now? There are going to be all these accountants. They're going to talk about these accounts. This is what they did in the 18th century before the French Revolution. And in Britain, when there's a big crisis, the tradition is to talk about accountants. There were no accountants. We never talked about accounts, and I thought, there's a story here.
Which raises the question then for the non-accountant observers is why were there no accountants? I mean, you mentioned the Fed being across the street, so, I mean, how could the information not have been in the hands of people who could do something about it?
I mean, this is a really good question, which I can't completely answer. How did people not know that all those CDOs, those mortgage bundles, which were propping up, and still, by the way, are propping up the financial system. How did they not know they were worthless? Some accountants were screaming about it. But remember, we don't pay a lot of attention to what accountants say. When they downgrade a country, America got downgraded, and there was a $2 trillion error. That was not big news for Americans. We don't really pay attention to accountants. So those accountants who did cry out that there was danger, people didn't listen to them. In fact, when there's a bubble or a boom, people don't like to hear these things. But the fact that accountants don't play a visual or a really any kind of role in our public life, I think is a danger.
Well, there's a real sort of resentment, too, isn't there? I mean, I can think of many situations in which the story here is, well, we really wanted to go with this big, bold thing, but the bean counter stopped us.
Well, there are two sides to that. First of all, this is absolutely true, in that if you are a high-risk entrepreneur, the bean counter might say you can't go to the moon, and you go to the moon, okay? I mean, there's no question there that the people who create big things, but it's very, very helpful while you are going to the moon or doing those projects to actually know what your accounts are. But I think at another level, I just think there's been a shift in society. For hundreds of years, accountants were out in front. They were in art, they were in culture, they were in the news. And they also spoke to a public which was much more literate in accounting. And so when there were crises, and I would say even after World War II, you would have accountants more in view, and the public would be demanding audits and having much more of a sense of how basic finance worked and how basic auditing and, you know, some can call it regulation, but in many cases it's just basic transparency and auditing, how that works.
You say accountants were in art and culture?
For hundreds and hundreds of years, great painters painted accountants, great writers wrote about accountants. They were in poetry. In Holland, the Dutch, who for 200 years, from about 1500 to 1700, had the world's most successful economy, they invented modern capitalism, the first publicly traded company, the first stock exchange. They were a society of accountants where everybody, high to low, learned accounting. And they painted accountants in beautiful paintings.
Well, we will talk about how much accounting makes empires possible as we resume on the Jefferson Exchange, talking to Jacob Soule about his book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. You can join our discussion on the exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Jacob and take your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Jacob Soule, a professor of history and accounting at USC. He's the author of The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. As you go through the histories in the book, you realize, wow, accounting really does make empires possible, both corporate and political. We'll talk about what happens when things go a little cattywampus with the accountants and the people's views of them. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We already talked about Louis XIV in France and him having the golden books for about 20 years and then deciding, you know what, the news isn't good, forget it. I don't want the accounting system anymore. Louis, obviously not the earliest example. How far back in time do we have to go to get the first evidence of accounting somewhat similar to what we know now?
Accounting as a written form appears before other languages in Mesopotamia. So it's actually the first human written form of language that we have. But accounting is part of government and something which we use to hold people truly accountable, I think, emerges in ancient Greece, as many things do, where even the priests, the high priests, had to have their books audited every year. That doesn't happen anymore in Greece, and they're suffering for it. But this problem of people using accounting and using it to as a management tool, which really works, I mean, you can't really do finance or business or government without it, but then throwing it away or shutting their eyes to it or closing it out, that's the phenomenon I found in the book, that we humans have a very funny relationship to this thing called accounting.
What records were available to you, and how much traveling did you have to do to access them?
Well, what happened was I was looking at how, you know, America was supposed to be in the business of nation building in 2007 and 8, and I was looking at how governments built themselves when people started really putting together big governments, whether it be in Medici Florence or in the Spanish Empire or the French or the Dutch. These were governments that were also putting out big empires, trade empires, slave networks. These are the empires that created, for better or worse, the modern age. And I started going into their archives, and I started meeting accountants, not just as kind of side guys, but in many cases as the leaders and the visionaries of how to create governments.
In a sense, I mean, were they urging fairly sound accounting practices? When you said it just now, I was thinking, oh, my God, these are the guys who came up with the first collateralized debt obligations or something. But, I mean, how bold were these first accountant leaders?
I mean, they were incredibly modern in many cases. In medieval Italy, where accounting was also, people were very fluent in accounting, you'd have often 40% of the population not only literate, but literate in accounting. This would be in Tuscany, in Genoa, in Venice. We see governments and leaders setting out central ledgers for their republics in, 1340, which can be and were expected to be audited. So this was, a sort of amazing phenomenon. And what I found in each case is that it went away, it disappeared. And the visionaries who, wanted and believed that governments needed not only to have good books, but they needed to be you know, audited now and then. They needed transparency of some sort, would often rise in government, and then they would get tossed out, often right at the moment when they're about to achieve transparency.
It seems like it's more democratic that way, though. I mean, basically, if more of the public knows about what is being done on behalf of the public, that seems like a system that is more or less anti-feudal and anti-dictatorial.
You got it. That, you know, that's a big part of the American Revolution. And I went into a library company in Philadelphia, which was first the biggest library in the colonies, and then it became Ben Franklin's library, he had a library company where he actually had books lent to people, but it has all these amazing archives. And what I found was that this was a central question for the early American founders. Not only were people like Ben Franklin obsessed with accounting, but people who were building governments or building this American democratic government put it in the Constitution, first of all. That's Article 1, Section 9, which is an accountability clause, which says the government needs to show its accounts now and then. But that, for example, in Pennsylvania, they believed that they needed to be so democratic that in the Pennsylvania legislature, they'd have an account book on a chain that everyone could go verify. And so they saw this as the very fundamental basis of democracy. So it's not a small thing, even in our history.
Jacob Soles, our guest. His book is The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations, here on the Jefferson Exchange. It's interesting you mentioned Ben Franklin, because it jogs my memory about a book I read, one of several, by John Paul Jones many years ago, the Navy captain, the early American Navy captain, suggesting that perhaps he could get a ship that was clad in copper, and Ben Franklin was the one who went, are you kidding me?
That would be the man to do it. Franklin taught himself accounting. He became obsessed by accounting. He kept moral account books. He wrote his autobiography in a ledger on the debit side. I mean, this is big stuff in his life. He kept all sorts of accounts. He wrote about how to keep accounts in his almanacs and his other advice books. And his letters are filled with discussions of the need for accounting, so much so that he believed that everyone in the colonies, to have a successful commercial culture, needed to know double entry accounting, which measures what's going in and what's going out, so you can actually see if you've made any errors. And he put in every post office — he was head of the British postal system — he put a manual of accounting on a poster on the wall of every post office. So this was no small thing for him, and it was lucky, because he negotiated our loans with Europe. And he did so successfully. We couldn't have won the war without those loans.
And he certainly was able to know what he was basing it on for collateral, all that sort of stuff. I mean, knew what the financial picture was backing him up on this side.
The collateral was the United States. If we didn't pay France back the £3 million we owed them, he knew, and actually Hamilton, after Franklin, they knew, because Alexander Hamilton was a trained accountant, that France would just take a chunk of the United States. That was the collateral. So America, as I say in the book, was born into debt, and Hamilton said that was the price of liberty. Luckily, there were good accountants who knew how to pay those debts back slowly and surely to build confidence with our lenders, because America had a debt from day one, and it was managed well enough that we survived, which was not necessarily, the obvious outcome.
So let me take an aside here, Jacob Soles, and cast this into modern terms. And I mean, if America was born into debt, does it not trouble you that America has a lot of debt at the moment, or is it a bit too much for your taste even?
It is a lot. It's gone up a lot in the last decade. One of the things that I have done is I've gone back and looked at historical debt. I mean, this is nothing compared to what the British had after World War II, but it can get out of control. I'm actually much more worried about municipal debt in the United States. We have terrible municipal accounting. One of the things that happens is that, I say this as someone whose grandparents were saved by a city pension fund, but, you know, giant pensions are accounted for with future tax revenue, and as we know, in many cities, that tax revenue hasn't come, and they account that into the future. So people don't have to think about it now. That's where if the public were more aware of accounting and its basic tricks, I think they would be a little bit more concerned and much more conservative. I don't mean politically, but just in spending. Got to be careful.
Oh, because assumptions are being made about future revenues, which are a bit optimistic, to put it mildly.
They're still doing it. And if you look at the debt loads, I mean, I live in Los Angeles. Los Angeles has a debt load that I really have to shut my eyes at. I can't even imagine how that's going to get paid. Nation states like the United States, that's different. We have the biggest Navy and Air Force in the world. It was bad if we don't pay our debt back, really, really bad. That's called the debt ceiling. We've got to keep paying it back. But we can do it. We just have to be careful. And it would be helpful if accountants were in the fore and Americans were more literate in accounting. At least that's what my historical research shows.
And that historical research is compiled in the book, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. Dr. Jacob Soles, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, professor of history and accounting at USC. You can join us, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So it appears that, one of your theses here is that the practice of accounting makes capitalism itself possible.
Well, this was, you know, all the thinkers of modern capitalism, this German guy named Max Weber, you know, he thought about capitalism and he thought that there was a Protestant work ethic behind it and he came up with a model for it. And he and a whole bunch of other German theorists of capitalism said double entry accounting is the basis of capitalism. And that is true. When the first companies are founded, what makes it possible is this management of money via sound, balanced books and a check and balance system within your books. But what they didn't see, and which I found, is that the system constantly fails. So you've got the foundation of capitalism being accounting. That's the management tool we use. But over and over again, without fail, humans mess it up or they ignore it. And that's something that, by the way, I wanted to mention this, the Dutch in their paintings warned about this danger. So they had these huge public paintings of people accounting, but they also warned, watch out. Don't think you can master this. This is something which can get the better of you. And in the end, you know, they would warn God as the final accountant who tallies, you know, sins and good works in the books of life and death, and that'll be the final reckoning. That'll be God. Don't have so much human pride that you think you're going to master this thing. And that's how the Dutch, for 200 years, were able to keep reforming themselves after they had plenty of crises, but they reformed them. And so it was that knowledge not only of accounting, but that it fails. That's what the Dutch used. We've forgotten that lesson.
It seems like it's a measure of, a measure that is right there in dollars and cents in front of you, or, you know, obviously in different denominations of currency, depending on where in the world. But if you don't know if you can trust somebody, at least you get to look at their books. But it sounds like what happens down the road is over time, the personal relationships or the like, well, they know what they're doing, become more important than the books.
I mean, look, people can falsify books, but who better to figure that out than someone who knows accounting? I mean, that's the thing. You know, it's sometimes more common people's relationships with their own books. They found all these modern syndromes. For example, the more financial duress you're under, the less likely, just like Louis XIV, the less likely you are to keep good books. And that's one of the reasons that the early medieval accounting manuals say people have to learn accounting when they're kids. They have to learn it as a discipline, and not everyone is born to do it, because when the bad numbers come in, you have to be tough enough to face them. So the first accounting manuals took account of this. Today, not only do we not know how to do accounting, we give it off to accountants. A lot of times people don't even trust accountants, although I think the average CPA is a very, very trustworthy figure. We just sort of ignore this stuff in our basic lives. I think historically that seems a phenomenon to me. It wasn't the case in commercial societies up until really modern accounting literacy, really the last 30 years. It's kind of disappeared.
I'm trying to think about pop culture references to accounting that isn't anything other than it's somebody over there, like Joe Walsh in his song saying, I have accountants pay for it all. You know, there are always the other people. I mean, at any time in history through your research, have you shown accountants who are really front and center characters?
Well, by the way, just another note. You know, today it's people like Rick Moranis in the first Ghostbusters. They're kind of silly nerds. And
right.
Yeah, no, I mean, accountants in Renaissance Florence, I mean, Cosimo Medici's pride was in being such a fine accountant. And a lot of the paintings around Cosimo Medici's circle are his accountants and their children. Those are the famous people. A lot of frescoes, if you go to Florence and you look at frescoes, in many cases you're looking at accountants' frescoes, frescoes of accountants. You go into the 18th century in Britain, and all these famous businessmen and bankers and imperialists painted themselves smiling over their account books. At the same time, in 19th century Britain, people like Charles Dickens, who was the most famous writer of the 19th century, his father was an accountant who was swindled by a dishonest accountant, and they went to debtor's prison for it. Dickens wrote about it, and in The Christmas Carol, Jacob Marley comes back to Scrooge in chains covered with account books. So they were out there. They were really in the consciousness of the public until, I would really say, after World War II, when the profession kind of, you know, leaves, let's say, the public imagination.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. Our guest is Jacob Soule. His book is The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. And you mentioned earlier this whole idea of the final accountability to God, or at least to somebody who you're going to have to answer to once you're gone, which was what Jacob Marley was saying to right. Ebenezer Scrooge. It's like, yeah, dude, you're making a bigger chain than this.
That's right. I mean, this is there's a funny thing about this. St. Matthew, who wrote his Gospels, he was a Jewish tax collector who was also an accountant, and Jesus came to him at the accounting table and brought him away from the accounting table. But in his Gospels, he talks about the parable of the talents, which is one in which you're supposed to invest your money well. But he also warned against worshiping mammon, and he warned against wealth. And one of the interesting things in the history of at least the West is that God is the final accountant who keeps books. And those books, by the way, have to be balanced at the end. But there's a kind of vagary in the Gospel of St. Matthew. He says at one level you've got to be a good financial manager, and at the other he says, don't worship money. So we've got that to struggle with, at least in this history, and this is a history of a European tradition. And it's not an easy struggle, and it's a big old story. Interestingly enough, those pictures of St. Matthew were also all across Europe. For hundreds of years, churches, almshouses, places where people taught, had big paintings of St. Matthew sitting over his account book. And that was very, clear in people's minds.
Interesting. St. Matthew before you get to St. Peter. You got to balance the books before you can get to St. Peter.
You got to try. Absolutely.
Let's take a call here. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jacob Soule, the author of The Reckoning.
Good morning.
Hi.
Years ago, I read a science fiction novel that was based on the premise that the Roman Empire failed at least partially because it had no double-entry bookkeeping.
Well, the Roman Empire does not have double-entry bookkeeping. It has stores accounting, in which, kind of like a checking account, you just figure out how much you've spent and how much you've got, but you don't balance your books and you don't have a profit concept. Historians argue about the Romans not having a sense of making profit. Whether or not that's true, they did not have double-entry accounting, which meant at the end of the day, they could not do complex accounting. They also had Roman numerals, and the number 856 is almost a paragraph.
Right.
It was impossible for them to do accounting. I would definitely argue that they were unable to create capitalist ventures on a complex scale like the Italians did in the Middle Ages because of that. That I would agree fully.
Mark, something in your tone of voice indicated you might have a follow-up.
Yes. My father, who was a real laissez-faire kind of guy, used to pray regularly, quite aloud, that God save us from a system run by bookkeepers and accountants.
All right.
Well, you know, this is the funny thing about this story. He probably wouldn't be wrong, although, you know, God's up there as the final accountant. This is the funny thing in this whole story, in that we all know the big accounting frauds of the 90s were a disaster, but at the same time, there were a lot of good accountants in there, and they're the people that had to clean the mess up. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, or I don't know what the metaphor is. We need accounting, but we've got to be really careful with it.
You had mentioned the Medicis and the folks in the nation states, the city states, you know, Genoa and Venice and all of those. And it fell out of favor. What caused accounting to fall out of favor?
Well, what happens is Spain takes over. Spain and France invade Italy, and they have great kings. And those kings saw accounting as beneath them. And while the locals kept good account books and the governments did, the bigger administration did not.
Much more to talk about with Jacob Soul. His book is The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations, an argument that accounting actually makes nation states and capitalism itself possible. We'll talk more with Jacob and take your phone calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about accounting through history, as told in the book by Professor Jacob Soul, The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise and Fall of Nations. Jacob Soul, Professor of History and Accounting at USC, the author of several other books and articles, and a regular on the TED Talk circuit, and a recipient of a MacArthur Genius Grant 3 years ago for his work at investigating and illuminating how modern governments came to be, and accounting is one of the ways they came to be. Join us on the exchange if you have questions or comments, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. We just talked about the medieval powers in Genoa and Venice, etc., Spain coming to power behind them, the Dutch coming to power as well. Did the Dutch add some wrinkles to accounting?
Well, I mean, what happens is that the Renaissance, the medieval and Renaissance states of Italy are republics. And they have transparency, some form or another. Whether it works or not, you know, depends, but they have it. And when the big monarchies come in, they don't have transparency at all. And behind them, though, starting in 1500, well, actually in 1581, Holland breaks away from Spain and becomes a republic. It's the most literate place for accounting. And what happens is a humanist becomes, a great scholar, a great water engineer. The Dutch need that. He's also a great accountant. He becomes one of the leaders of the Republic, and he recommends that all citizens and princes alike, all the leaders, the citizens, everybody in the street, everybody learn accounting. And the Dutch basically start funding public accounting schools in their big cities. And this helps engender trust. And that means that the tax collector, the butcher, everybody you can imagine, you went to school with them, it's a small place, and you know they learned accounting. And more or less, there was more trust in the books. And by the time they start floating shares in 1602 for the first time, there's enough trust to open a stock market and people come in off the street and buy shares. So accounting in Holland, really, they create an accountable society with a certain level of trust. And that's where it all begins.
Well, and then contrast that with American society at this point in time, where not a lot of people understand accounting and not a lot of people trust the government's books at any level.
I mean, that's absolutely right, and I'd take it one step further. Are people really successfully right now investing in stocks? Do you really understand the balance sheets of your companies out there, at least the ones that are published? It's tough. And how much trust do we have right now? Investing is one of the most important things in a commercial society, which we have. And as a citizen, I myself actually only invest in mutual funds that are, backed up, for example, by my university. In my attempts to invest personally, I have not done so. Others I know have done better, but it's very, very hard with the financial information out there. And much harder still if you don't know how to read a balance sheet. The information that they hold is actually pretty minimal, but that accounting training, just basic accounting training, will obviously help you see risk.
So balance sheets, quarterly reports, annual reports, are these a little fudgy still, or are they at least being as honest as they need to be?
I would say that we need much more on our balance sheets, for sure. The balance sheet is just a snapshot. They don't tell you long-term risks and other things. And there are regulations which allow companies to show you as little as possible. So that's something I would just say, as a concerned investor and citizen, it would be great to have more information on those sheets. By the way, before the Great Depression, there were no rules about balance sheets. And what do you think happened? All the companies published phony balance sheets. And when the Great Depression happened, that's when you got accounting reform. And part of the reforms of the Great Depression and the Glass-Steagall Act, which followed, were these enormous accounting reforms that happened in the government. And by the end of it, there are all these rules about what companies had to do and how they had to be audited and how the auditing companies would work. And they slowly created the Securities and Exchange Commission. So this comes out of the Great Depression, the fact that we had no rules about balance sheets.
And, of course, Glass-Steagall was repealed about 16 years ago, and there's still a continual fight over, well, let's not be too hard on the people on Wall Street. They know what they're doing.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, really. Let's take some calls. Here's Brad in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jacob Soule, the author of The Reckoning.
Yes. Yeah. Would that we had a balance sheet on the CIA and these people who hire Blackwater-type firms. I approach this. I'm appreciating the show because it's my least favorite topic. Or activity, I should say.
Yeah.
And I ran a small business for a while, and I recently put all these pieces of paper that I had to collect and put down on another piece of paper and put a number here, put it there. And then I have this big pile of paper that's a burn pile now. And I have two things to say about that. One is it gives me some sympathy for those who resent the government. Poking into our little businesses and demanding in a sort of demeaning way all this information on a quarterly basis. And it was dislikable to have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, I look at this big pile of paper and I think how much of my life went into keeping a piece of paper in my wallet, pulling it out, writing it down in another place, transferring it here, making a report to the government, and on and on. And then I think about all the people in our society that are spending their life energy doing this kind of thing, and I'm not convinced that it's really the best thing for humanity to be doing, even though I'm open to this man's interesting propositions here.
All right.
Maybe some response on those. Thank you.
Thank you, Brad.
Well, let me just two things. First of all, on the CIA and Blackwater, one of the oldest things in the book for not giving up your accounts is called national security. The Spanish did it. The Dutch even refused to open their books at one point for national security, all the way up until the First World War and the Second World War, when they find out that the British Navy has been keeping bad books and no one can audit them because of national security. So that's where you never get the books opened up. You usually find the biggest accounting fraud where they don't open up the books. If it makes you feel any better, one of the definitions of modern humans that we have is that they start keeping these books. So if you go back to the Middle Ages, people make the same complaint that we just heard. These guys in Tuscany are grumpy that they've kept all their receipts. They're not grumpy. They've kept them in their books, and they think that they've managed their money well, but they don't like the government coming in and taxing them. So they keep two sets of books, and one's called a secret book, and the other book is for the tax man. I don't know how much things have changed since 1375. But if it makes you feel any better, we've been doing this a long time. I think what worries me more is how few people actually keep books and have any clue of what they're doing with their receipts or anything. They just kind of let the bank do it, or they, you know, look online and sort of calculate it, but they have no idea what's going on. You know, the generation, for example, my grandparents wrote everything down, and they kept their books, they balanced their books at bedtime. The old tradition there was you would pray, you would do your lessons, and you balance your books. And that was part of the same discipline. It was a religious moment in which you balanced your books and you prayed and you kind of made your, you did your reckoning with God.
Right, yeah, reckoning, exactly. That's great. It's you know, I'm surprised at the number of times I get behind somebody in line at a store and the clerk will say, "Do you want your receipt?" because they use their debit card. Nah, don't bother. Interesting stuff. Let's go to, Peter in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jacob Soule, the author of The Reckoning.
Good morning. I was wondering if you could offer any suggestions for books or even games that pertain to this for kids. I just started listening. I'm not sure if you talked about kids or not.
No.
Haven't gotten to that now, but that's a great question. Thanks for that, Peter.
You know, I was just asked this question last night by my own family, and I didn't have a good answer. I said, no, they're going to learn how to do real bookkeeping because it's going to keep them out of trouble. And someone in my family said, how are you going to do that? And I said, I'm going to find them a teacher, you know, just like in the Middle Ages, to have them do this. From what I understand from studying this, you're right, it'd be great to have a game for this, a good game. And Monopoly doesn't hurt. You know, it's just at least for them to get a sense of what they do and don't have. But there isn't a game, and we don't have that as part of our society. If you look at the children's education books from the 18th and 19th centuries backwards, they always have these little, you know, abacus tables or accounting tables for kids to do along with their alphabets. And in fact, the teaching of writing was usually connected with accounting because you needed to have good handwriting to keep good books, so they taught it at the same time. So I'll have to get back to you on that one, but that's something that I'm dealing with myself.
Interesting. All right, let's take a call from Rex in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jacob Soule. His book is The Reckoning.
Well, it seems to me that learning accounting, which I got to take one semester in college, so that was wonderful, but it seemed to me that learning accounting is like learning another language. You get some colloquial expressions, you get some new phrases, get a new way to think about things.
All right. Thanks for that, Rex.
Yeah, I mean, this is, well, look, I mean, I'll tell you, first of all, you bet. You start seeing the numbers in a very different way. You're taught to handle them in a systematic way. But you're also taught, I've had arguments debates with accountants and with people in finance and with people in government as to whether we should teach accounting, make it part of the curriculum, which I say we should. And they said, well, we just need financial calculation taught. And I say, no, double entry accounting, because there's a moral to that story. The moral is you balance your books every day. That's part of the rule, is every day you go to those books and you balance them, and you know if you've got a profit or a loss, and that balance at the end shows if you've done your job well. And that's part of that language of balance, and that was very, very connected to, for example, the Bible. And so throughout Western history, there's been this long tradition of this kind of moral language of finance. We don't have it anymore, because people don't do that. And in fact, they don't know what double entry bookkeeping is, and they don't know exactly what it means to balance your books, which means that, you know, your debits and your credits, your income and your expenditure are the same. You've not made an error. That's what it means. So it's a moral language that also comes with that kind of accounting. I think it's essential. At least historically, it's been.
And I'm noticing an interesting parallel here, that we've lost interest in accounting through the decades and centuries, and moved away from religion at the same time. You could choose which one you think is the greater impact in this context. Let's talk to Dennis and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jacob Soule, the author of The Reckoning.
Hi. Say, my question is, you always hear pundits, usually right-wing pundits who are supposedly economists, say that the government should keep their books the way the average Joe keeps his books at the kitchen table, you know, and you can't, the guy at the kitchen table knows that he can't spend his money this way or that way, and blah, blah, blah. And I've always thought that that is the stupidest analogy in the world. And I want to know, do you think it is a good analogy or not?
Yeah, the whole belt tightening for a family versus belt tightening for a country. A lot of people have made some complaints about that. Thanks for that, Dennis. What do you think, Jacob?
First of all, the average Joe is probably not keeping their books at their kitchen table. That's the problem. The second thing is, no, you can't make the same. It's just not the same thing for a government. For large military commercial governments have always had debt, and if they've got big armies, they can get into trouble. The French had a revolution, but France is still there. They've eventually paid their debts, but that's a long story. The other thing is this. I will agree with this. The government does not follow the generally accepted accounting principles. It doesn't follow the basic rules of accounting. It doesn't use accrual accounting. It doesn't use the best forms of accounting. It really ought to. And that's something that the public doesn't even know about. And by the way, that's a question that I would hope would be a nonpartisan agreement issue. We can all agree the government should use the clearest, most transparent, competent forms of accounting possible, and it doesn't. I would also say average people should do the same. Neither are. And that's one of the things I point out in my book, is that, you know, on both sides of the spectrum, we've got work to do. We've got work to do on individuals, and we've got work to do on government. The problem is, I think we have a lot of work to do on both sides. I think that we're kind of in a hole. So, you know, we got work to do.
Well, the generally accepted accounting principles, the GAAP that you just mentioned briefly there, I mean, are they a good set? Are they even up to date for these times in which we have a global interconnected economy?
A good accountant will tell you, you know, accounting can never follow economies and financial products as fast as they emerge, and that accounting is often is very flawed, and it's a snapshot, and it's not accurate. And accountants always want to tell you beforehand that they can't produce total accuracy. GAAP would help. Sure, it's impossible to keep up. Every time you create some way of auditing, some trick emerges in the financial industry to get around that. However, GAAP is better than what we have now. And also, the government doesn't have real-time accounting. It can't often tell you what it has at a certain time, and it also doesn't take into enough credit all of its risks and all of its debts. So I do think that we could have work to do, and a lot of people in the accounting community have been pushing for that, and it hasn't happened because once you have those accounts and they're clearer, everybody can be held much more accountable.
Well, you got quite the cascade of phone calls and emails here, some of which we can't get to. My apologies to the last four people who emailed. I won't have time to get to your stuff, but it really is a corker of a tale about accounting and how it figures in our history. The Reckoning, Financial Accountability and the Rise of Fall of Nations is the book. Jacob Soll, S-O-L-L, its author, our guest. Jacob, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You bet. That'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Tomorrow on the Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about the new Housing Choice Act that took effect in Oregon a week ago. In our Vents Day segment, we'll talk about changing the electoral college and how. We'll also talk about whether it's time to regulate social media like Facebook based on that recent experiment. At 9 o'clock, we'll talk about patient-centered medical homes and what those do and how they work. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening and have a great day.